What were the real motivations behind the U.S. war on Vietnam? What happened during the My Lai massacre, and how did it alter public perception of the war? How have governments attempted to combat anti-war sentiment since Vietnam? What lessons can we draw from My Lai 50 years later? Did Canada play a quiet role in aiding and abetting that war? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we commemorate the anniversary of one of the most horrific war crimes of the Vietnam era, the My Lai Massacre, with three related interviews. History professor Christian Oppy provides us an overview of My Lai within the context of the Vietnam War and its impact on the American psyche. We hear from retired U.S. Army colonel turned peace activist Anne Wright about her visit to My Lai on that anniversary. And we hear from prominent Canadian foreign policy critic Eve Engler about Canada's underreported support for America's military adventures in the South Asian country. On this week's program, My Lai 50 Years Later, Reflections on the Vietnam War and Its Meaning Today. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 16th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In a bitter irony, Colin Powell, who was responsible for the cover-up of the My Lai massacre, acceded to a brilliant career in the armed forces. In 2001, he was appointed Secretary of State in the Bush administration. Although never indicted, Powell was also deeply implicated in the Iran-Contra affair. It is worth noting that Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time of the Gulf War, which resulted in the deaths of thousands of retreating Iraqi soldiers in what British war correspondent Felicity Arbuthnot entitled Operation Desert Slaughter. Quote, "The 42-day carpet bombing enjoined by 32 other countries against a country of just 25 million souls with a youthful conscript army with broadly half the population under 16 and no air force was just the beginning of a United Nations-led global siege of near-medieval ferocity." Unquote. That comes from the introduction by Michelle Chosudovsky under the headline Cover-up of Extensive War Crimes, 50th Anniversary of the My Lai Massacre, posted March 16th. World leaders must settle their disputes through dialogue. Thus, I urge the Human Rights Council to appoint a special rapporteur for the human rights situation in Iraq. I urge the United Nations to condemn illegal acts of aggression, torture, and mass killings, including those committed by powerful countries like the United States. And I ask my countrymen and women in America to walk back from the abyss of empire. We have a special duty to hold our leaders responsible, to make redress to the Iraqi people, and to promote and sustain the global peace. That comes from a statement given by Inder Komar at a side event of the 37th regular session of the UN Human Rights Committee in Geneva, Switzerland, on March 15, 2018, under the headline U.S.-UK Crime of Aggression Against Iraq 2003. War was not conducted in self-defense. Posted March 16th. Anything the West wants to bomb, be it in Syria, Iraq, or potentially Iran, Lebanon, Yemen, or even Afghanistan, in Incirlik is there, with perfect infrastructure and a fantastic geographical location. For NATO, a dream come true place, really. But only until recently, until Mr. Erdogan's era, until the 2016 failed coup and the consequent, incomprehensible but real, Turkish rebellion. Suddenly, Turkey is not trusted anymore, at least not in the Western capitals. That is perhaps very good for Turkey and its future, but definitely not for NATO. That comes from the article, Why Are NATO Air Forces Moving from Turkey to Jordan? By Andrei Vilchik, posted March 15th. It is without any doubts that the U.S. foreign policy after 1989 is still unrealistically following the French concept of raison d'état that indicates the realist justification for policies pursued by state authority, but in the American eyes, first and foremost of these justifications or criteria is the U.S. global hegemony as the best guarantee for the national security, followed by all other interests and associated goals. Therefore, the U.S. foreign policy is based on a realpolitik concept, that is a German term referring to the state foreign policy ordered or motivated by power politics. The strong do what they will, and the weak do what they must. However, the U.S. is becoming weaker and weaker, and Russia and China are more and more becoming stronger and stronger. Finally, it seems to be true that such a reality in contemporary global politics and international relations is properly understood and recognized by a newly elected U.S. President Donald Trump. If he is going not to be just another Trojan horse of the U.S. neocon concept of Pax Americana, there are real chances to get rid of the U.S. imperialism in the nearest future and to establish international relations on a more democratic foundation. That comes from the article, Pax Americana versus Russia, Is There an End to U.S. Imperialism? By Dr. Vladislav B. Sotirovich, posted March 15th, originally appearing at Oriental Review. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The Vietnam War's impact on America was legendary. 58,000 U.S. soldiers killed, millions of Vietnamese and Cambodians slaughtered. The anniversary of the infamous My Lai massacre is cause for reflection on not only that incident, but the entirety of the war and its aftermath. The Global Research News Hour had a chance to open up a conversation recently with a renowned academic expert on the subject. Christian Oppie is professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of three books about the American War in Vietnam, including his most recent American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. He joins us now from Amherst, Massachusetts. Good to have you on the program, Professor Oppie.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Now, I think this being the 50th anniversary of the My Lai massacre, I wanted to first of all put the My Lai massacre in its proper context, the Vietnam War. You point out that the war was propelled by a narrative of American exceptionalism and that America's involvement in Vietnam was initially sold to the American people as an act of benevolence toward the Vietnamese people. Could you maybe just first of all give us an overview of what the actual economic and political interests at stake were for the U.S., which were being masked by this facade of humanitarian concern?
Well, in the decades after World War II, the United States clearly wanted to maintain its global preeminence, and it justified its assertion of military power around the globe, of course, on the grounds that it was engaged in a global contest with aggressive communism, and therefore needed to come to the aid of small countries around the world who were resisting this kind of aggression. But clearly the United States was determined to shore up capitalist allies around the world. And in the Pacific, the concern, the primary concern, was finding allies along with Japan, the main ally. And in terms of the economic underpinning of intervention in Vietnam, it's a little tricky or complicated because there was not, as there was in the Middle East, an obvious economic resource or motivation in Vietnam itself. But there clearly was a desire to build an economic structure throughout the Pacific so that not just the United States, but Japan and the Philippines and other American allies or sort of semi-protectorates, or in the case of the Philippines, who's just a recent colony, that they would have trading partners and that there would be a strong capitalist economy throughout that region. And you'll remember, of course, the domino theory, which most people think of as just a sort of a political idea that if communism is allowed to develop and flourish in one country, the neighboring country will automatically fall to a communist regime. But that's also an economic theory, the idea being if that one country goes communist, you're going to lose economic access, not only to that country, but potentially the neighboring countries as well.
Throughout the 60s and the lead up to My Lai, the nobility of the American cause was already starting to be questioned. I mean, was it not?
Yeah, that's one of the great achievements of the anti-war movement, was to raise these fundamental questions about the official justifications of the war. It was ever more evident that the regime in South Vietnam was not an independent nation, but was in fact entirely dependent on U.S. economic and military support. And had the United States not intervened in the 1950s, Vietnam would have been reunited under one government, as was called for by the Geneva Accords of 1954. There was never to be two permanent separate Vietnams. But that was, in fact, the American mission for 21 years, was to build and bolster a permanent non-communist country called South Vietnam. And it was also ever more evident that South Vietnam was nothing like a democracy, but in fact repressed dissent and acted very much like a police state. Did not have the sufficient support of its own people to stand in, to be able to maintain itself without massive American support. So all of those realities were becoming more known to the American public even before the My Lai massacre was exposed in the press some 20 months after the massacre actually took place, exactly 50 years ago today.
There was Muhammad Ali's statement, and listener advisory, I'm going to use the N-word here. Muhammad Ali's statement about refusing to fight in Vietnam was seen as a big problem for U.S. war planners, when he said, "No Viet Cong ever called us nigger," and essentially that this was a white man's war. And of course, there was Martin Luther King, as you pointed out in your article, linking the struggle for racial justice in America with the peace movement and the divisions along the lines of race and class among the fighting men on the front, which were becoming quite evident. Could you comment on how critical was that racial dimension continuing to undermine the narrative and as well as general popular support for the war?
It was very critical precisely because Americans, and not just African Americans, but all Americans, were beginning to see the racial significance of the war, both in Vietnam and at home, and making those connections. The war did have a racial component, in the sense that the major American measurement of success in Vietnam was the infamous body count. That is to say, the U.S. military did not seek to gain territory or secure it, or did not measure its success by how many South Vietnamese sided with the Americans, but primarily measured success based on how many enemy soldiers were killed. And with that as the incentive, when civilians were killed, they were often included in the body count, as if they were enemy that had successfully been defeated. So this was also stimulated increasingly by a kind of a racial demonization of the Asian enemy, for which there were a lot of historical antecedents going back, at least as far as the war to conquer the Philippines at the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And then on forward from that, in the Pacific War, the very brutal Pacific War during World War II against the Japanese, and then the war in Korea as well. So the G word, you know, referring to Vietnamese as gooks, it was already well in place before Vietnam. And, you know, it led to this very crude sort of attitude in the field, summarized by a kind of slogan, which is that if it's, it was sometimes, you know, said, often said actually by American soldiers, if it's Vietnamese and it's dead, it's Viet Cong. Meaning we don't have to be too fussy about whether the Vietnamese body is actually a fighter, as long as it's Vietnamese, we'll call it that.
Which gets us to My Lai. 50 mm-hmm. years ago today, a squadron known as Charlie Company descended on this small hamlet, and they'd been given information that it was occupied by Viet Cong planning an attack, and that information turned out to be fraudulent. Could you remind our listeners of some of what happened on that day 50 years ago?
Well, you set it up correctly. This company in the AmeriCal division had been told by their captain the night before in a kind of pep talk that they had intelligence that when they entered this village the next morning, they would be facing a very substantial force of Viet Cong, and that therefore there would be an opportunity finally to get vengeance on an enemy that had successfully killed a number of men in that particular unit through sniper fire and landmines. And beyond that, the captain also said, so when you go into that village, you know, nothing should live when nothing should still be alive when we leave that village. Accounts differ on exactly what the words were, but very much got the impression that that they were being ordered to wipe out this entire village. But when they did go in the next day, what has to be remembered is it wasn't a kind of very rapid, spontaneous massacre. It was much more systematic and took place over a period of 4 hours. And in fact, there was no hostile fire whatsoever. The American soldiers came into that village. The villages were primarily women and children and babies and older men. There were not military-aged Vietnamese in the village. They were unarmed and they were unresisting. And not everyone participated in the massacre, but dozens of soldiers did. Sometimes at the beginning, they were killing people in small numbers out in the fields, but as they got into the village proper, they began to round people up in groups and put them down into ditches and fired upon them. But beyond that, it was one of the, I mean, in addition to the sheer murder of these people, they were engaged in mutilations and many rapes, and ultimately killed some 500 Vietnamese civilians. And in the after-action reports filed by American officers, there was an immediate cover-up of what had happened. And indeed, they reported that the Charlie Company had actually engaged in a successful firefight against enemy troops, killing 128. They just invented this figure out of thin air. 128 enemy soldiers were killed. And that appeared actually the next day in the New York Times. There were no journalists on the spot to counter the official after-action report, so that for the next 20 months, the massacre was successfully hidden from the American public. But there was, in fact, there were a couple of reasons why it got exposed. One was that an American soldier who was in Vietnam, not there that day at My Lai, ran into some guys who were at My Lai, who he had trained with, and heard stories about it. And he was appalled, so that when he came back to the United States, this man was named Ron Ridenour, he decided to write a very detailed letter about what he had heard and send it to authorities in Washington, anybody he could think to in the Pentagon and Congress. And that did finally lead to a military investigation, and which was, you know, no one was really paying much attention to it down in Georgia until Seymour Hirsch, the investigative reporter, started to pick up on it. And then finally, some photographs emerged that were taken by not a civilian journalist, but by a military photographer whose assignment was to follow this unit and take photographs. And he had saved some. Instead of turning them all over to the military, he had saved some and brought them home, and they were published by a Cleveland newspaper and then ultimately in Life magazine and then in newspapers all over the world.
Now, I mean, I think in the abstract, you can hardly argue that this one instance was any more destructive than the bombing and the napalming and then the, you know, Agent Orange and other things that were being used. But I think that the very inhumanity that was demonstrated here, that so much goes against this narrative that, you know, the Americans are out to bring peace and democracy and freedom and whatnot, is so dramatically contradicted by My Lai that I think Americans couldn't help but be shocked by the revelations. There were also these thousands of Americans who insisted on defending William Cayley, who was the leader of the expedition, and basically turned into a kind of a martyr when they arrested him and tried him. Of course, there's also the I think in one of the cases there's a family member of one of the participants in My Lai. Who expressing disgust with their country. And at the end of the chapter in your book where you mention My Lai, you quote Miedlo's mother saying, "I raised him up to be a good boy and did everything I could. They come along and took him to the service. He fought for his country and look what they done to him, made him a murderer." So could I just get you to comment on that that diversity of responses in reaction to that?
I think you put it really well. I mean, yes, I do think the greatest number of Vietnamese civilians killed by the American military were killed by indiscriminate bombing, not face-to-face executions. But the My Lai massacre was not entirely exceptional. We just don't know any that took place at that scale. It was so shocking to the American public that many, at first anyway, denied it entirely. This couldn't have happened. This couldn't have been done by American boys. This has to be some kind of propaganda photographs that have, an atrocity that actually committed by the enemy. But even, gradually, of course, the evidence was overwhelming and undeniable. But Americans many of them tried every possible way to explain it away, including the standard argument that, in war, there will always be atrocities, and this sort of thing is done by all sides, and even worse, by our enemies. And, one of the things that really interests me about that response is that not just that it's intended to try to somehow exonerate American troops, but once you have admitted that, all countries, all cultures, all people are capable of that kind of evil, you really have kind of thrown out the window the very premise of American exceptionalism, which is, at the heart of which is this idea that Americans are uniquely virtuous and they put a higher price on life than other countries or cultures. So if, in fact, everybody does it, you're kind of making a giant concession. I mean, it's also a way of not taking seriously the responsibility of both, the individuals who are doing it, but certainly the more important responsibilities of the policymakers that are putting troops into those situations and in various ways through their policies, making these kinds of slaughters inevitable. Not inevitable that everybody would do it, but inevitable that large numbers of civilians under these circumstances would be killed.
Now, bringing us up to the present, we've seen efforts by the mandarins in the halls of power in Washington. They are determined to execute those various capitalist and foreign policy mandates that we discussed like earlier in the interview, and they want to return to that militarism. And we're seeing it being displayed, but they've got to overcome Vietnam. Could you, explain the ways in which they've managed to?
Yeah, that's a huge question. But one element of it that I would mention that I think has been very effectively encouraged over the decades since the Vietnam War, a way really of kind of forgetting about the worst of the war, is to rehabilitate the image of the military and those who serve it. So one of the obvious things about American culture, particularly since 9/11, is this sort of ritualistic way in which we honor military service, and how we confer on everyone who's in the military an automatic kind of hero status, regardless of what they do or how they behave. We are, in a variety of ways, deferring to them and honoring them, but not, you know, often the very empty gestures, you know, these kinds of flyovers at sporting events, or you know, thank you for your service, you know, routinely said to soldiers and veterans. And at the same time that we're doing that, over the last the decades since Vietnam, there's also been a tendency in our culture and politics to demonize the anti-war movement, which was, after all, the most vibrant and diverse and extraordinary in our history, but to reduce it to a sort of crude stereotype of people that were really seeking only to save their own skin, and were, in fact, you know, as it was claimed, not just disrespectful to the flag and to the nation, but, you know, really cruel in the way they treated returning veterans. You know, the sort of mythology about, you know, largely fictional ideas of meant really to demonize this anti-war movement, and therefore the legacies of that dissent, to try to quiet dissent in the present.
So just to close, I mean, the need for an anti-war movement is as urgent as ever. What advice would you give to those who wish to see the anti-war movement remobilized as it was in the Vietnam era?
Well, I mostly to suggest to them that while it didn't end the war immediately, and many feel that it was only a partial success, it did finally end the war, and it did bring down two presidents, and that it provided a model of extraordinary activism, not just the anti-war movement, but all the movements of the 60s, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement. And now we're seeing, I think, among younger people, a new emergence of activism. I mean, most recently with these high school walkouts over the prompted by the most recent school shooting in Florida. And I think if young people can make connections to older activists, and more than that, make connections to other movements, we really have the prospects for some real change. I mean, I'm hopeful that Black Lives Matter and domestic efforts for social justice will merge with movements for global climate justice and sort of anti-imperial efforts to rein in American military aggression and, throughout the world. So it's a big, you know, obviously that's a huge project, but I do think that there is less cynicism than there was some years ago about the possibility of forcing a change. I think there, for a long time, we've lived in this environment where many people have felt that the powers that make war are so impervious to dissent and have a kind of life of their own that there's nothing ordinary citizens can do to check that power. But I'm hopeful that is actually beginning to change.
Professor Oppie, we really value your insights. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing them with us.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor of History Christian Oppie. He specializes on the Vietnam War and has written three books on the subject, including his most recent American Reckoning, The Vietnam War and Our National Identity, published by Viking Press. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Okay, so this is Michael Welch for the Global Research News Hour. And right now, as this program goes to air on March 16th, exactly 50 years after the notorious event known as the My Lai Massacre, a number of Americans spent the day today in the actual village, which has been turned into a monument commemorating the victims who perished in that slaughter. One of them is retired Colonel Anne Wright. She's now an outspoken critic of America's military adventures and has been for more than a decade. She's active with Veterans for Peace, and her delegation is delivering a letter of apology to the people of Vietnam. And she joins us from Vietnam. Anne Wright, it's good to have you join us.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Could you give us the scoop on what you participated in earlier today?
Yes, today I was with a group of Veterans for Peace, an international organization of veterans who are opposed to war. And we were at My Lai, one of four villages that the U.S. military, U.S. Army personnel went into on March 16th, 1968. And at the end of a four-hour rampage, had killed 504 civilians. We were there to, as veterans of the U.S. military, to give our apologies to the Vietnamese people, as you say, and to acknowledge the deaths of 182 women, including 17 pregnant women, 173 children, including 68 that were under the age of five, 89 middle-aged people, and 60 people that were over the age of 60. So this horrific slaughter is something that is certainly a horrific stain on the United States, as well as its military, and our apologies were the least we could do for that terrible, terrible massacre.
And I'm curious to know what was going through your mind having visited that site. I'm sure you're familiar with the horrors, I mean, historically and reading about it, but I'm wondering, were there any unexpected feelings that rose up within you being at the scene of the crime, so to speak?
Well, seeing all the Vietnamese that had come to the commemoration, and just thinking of them as potentially, you know, people that could have been there on that day, and we saw a lot of older people that were there, some of whom I'm sure were around in those villages and survived that horrific time. We also saw a lot of very young kids there, and thinking about them and how in the world could our U.S. military troops have killed all of these kids? I mean, 173 of them were just kids, and thinking of young men, 18, 19, 20 years old, who seemed to have no problem with murdering these little kids. It just was—it's beyond belief what they did.
And scanning the major U.S. media this morning, I've so far seen very little reference to the My Lai anniversary. And you know, when the anniversary is mentioned, it's hardly front page news or a top story. What does it say to you as a former soldier and as a peace activist that Americans will faithfully mourn and mark the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, but they hardly seem to acknowledge the anniversary of My Lai?
Well, it's true. I think it's one of those things that I think most Americans would just like to sweep under the carpet. It's such a shame and embarrassment that I think our media that did not cover the massacre. I mean, it was well over a year before Seymour Hersh wrote an article about it, and the mainstream media that should have really been covering that and digging into it much earlier didn't. So I think for the American public and the American media, they just would like to forget it. And yet we can't, because it's the it's the basis, really, for many of the other things that have happened. I mean, if you think of Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq, when you think of Guantanamo and things that our military have done to people over even the last 18 years, I think a lot of it can be traced back to the fact that those who were involved in this massacre really got no punishment at all.
From what I've seen of the site in videos and photographs, it seems like the depictions of the massacre are justifiably very sympathetic to the victims, the Vietnamese victims, while the American soldiers are portrayed like monsters. And I'm not saying that's inappropriate, but I imagine that, as a peaceful person myself, if that was my introduction to the American people, I would hate Americans for what they did to my country. How, from what you've experienced, how receptive are visiting Americans to this site?
Well, it is remarkable how the Vietnamese people, after the United States killed 3 million of them, how we are received here. And it's with grace and courtesy and respect. And the Vietnamese say, we look forward, not backward, but we appeal to you not to do this to anyone else. And of course, the United States has done the same thing to other countries since then. In fact, in Afghanistan and in Iraq and Syria and Libya, the United States continues to kill civilians. And their appeal, the appeal of the Vietnamese people to us as American citizens to try to stop this warmongering of our country, it makes me feel sad that we're not able to stop our country. It continues to be a warring country, and we kill innocent civilians frequently. Right now, the United States is killing people in 7 countries. So I'm afraid the appeal of the Vietnamese people for us to not do to others that what we have done to them has fallen on deaf ears.
Has this encounter from earlier today left you more or less optimistic about the future of humanity?
Well, it leaves me optimistic that people can forgive, and the Vietnamese have forgiven the United States. But it leaves me pessimistic about our ability to influence our own country to stop doing this to others. And it really reinforces our commitment as Veterans for Peace to continue our work and to try our very best to work to make sure that people who come into office, who are elected into office, are not warmongers. But we're not having any luck in that. So it's hurtful in that way.
Yeah, I know you have to go in a minute, but I just wanted to, like, one more point. I know there's a big military parade planned for November 11th, Armistice Day, Veterans Day, as you call it in the United States. So I'm wondering what lessons should the American people and its allies abroad be drawing from the example of My Lai?
Well, with that giant military parade that President Trump has said he wanted to kind of emulate what he saw in Paris last year, our Veterans for Peace organization has already come out against having a military parade like that. We think it only bolsters those who want to use the military in invading and occupying other countries. And we do not want that, and we will certainly keep in mind what the outgrowth of all of these military incursions is, which is the innocent slaughter of civilians. And we will be recommitting ourselves to stop that under the Trump administration.
Thank you so much, Anne Wright, for making the time to talk to this very important subject, especially at the end of what must have been for you a very long and emotionally exhausting day.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for your interest in it, and we really appreciate the work that you do, and please keep up the great spirit. Thank you.
Bye for now. We've been speaking with retired U.S. Colonel turned peace activist Anne Wright, returning from the site of the My Lai massacre from earlier today.
As a Canadian radio program focused on the theme of the Vietnam War, it seems irresistible to delve into the role of Canada in that conflict. Most Canadians seem satisfied that Canada was antagonistic or at least distanced from the U.S. Indochina conflict, but there is overwhelming documentary evidence to the effect that Canada was entirely complicit in that war. To get some sense of the extent of that involvement, we are joined once again by one of Canada's leading dissident thinkers on the subject of Canadian foreign policy. His name is Yves Engler. He's the author of 9 books, including The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy from 2009, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt from 2012, and his latest, A Propaganda System, How Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. He joins us now from Montreal. In your 2012 book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt, you point out that far from being antagonistic toward the U.S. war effort, Canada was directly complicit. And you even mention numerous occasions where Prime Minister Pearson, as quoted in the parliamentary record known as Hansard, expressed support for the aims and objectives of the U.S. in Vietnam. I mean, it's pretty indisputable, is it not?
It's indisputable, but the overwhelming majority of foreign policy literature in this country, particularly from the liberal end of the political spectrum, has been able to convert Lester Pearson into a peace advocate, anti-war advocate, when, you know, as you mentioned in his own words, in the House of Commons, repeatedly sided with the U.S. War effort and in his actions as well. So, for instance, huge increase in Canadian weapon sales to the U.S. during the war, increase in different testing of U.S. chemical weapons in CFB Gagetown, explicitly, according to internal documents, for sort of replicate the foliage that existed in South Vietnam, so the Americans have a sense of how it would be useful in South Vietnam. To Lester Pearson having Canadian officials deliver U.S. bombing threats to the North Vietnamese, and that's why Noam Chomsky has referred to Lester Pearson as a war criminal for his role, particularly around delivering U.S. bombing threats to the North Vietnamese, which of course was a serious violation of international law and led to 100,000 plus people being killed.
Maybe we should go back to that period just after the Second World War. I mean, there's this International Control Commission, you know, and somehow that was leveraged by then External Affairs Minister Pearson in order to service certain, essentially U.S. imperial interests.
Yeah, so the International Control Commission was set up to bring about the reunification of North and South Vietnam peacefully, ideally. And Canada was the West's representative. Poland was the Eastern Bloc's representative, and India was the neutral member. So Canada was explicitly representing Western interests on this commission, so that was understood that you know Canada was aligned with the U.S. But then in the particulars, the Canadian government advanced U.S. aims. So, for instance, Canadian ICC commissioners were spying on the North Vietnamese for the Americans they were delivering. So they were there because they were part of the International Control Commission, but then they were passing on intelligence to the Americans. As I mentioned, they delivered U.S. bombing threats that came out in the Pentagon Papers. That Pentagon Papers being the internal American government documents that were leaked detailing U.S. War objectives, war aims, methods, etc. And so Canada was aligned with U.S. policy through the International Control Commission. Also, you actually want to go back a little bit further and French colonialism in Vietnam. Canada provided huge amounts of weaponry through the NATO's Mutual Assistance Program, beginning in the early 50s, or late 1940s, early 50s, to the French when they were suppressing or attempting to suppress colonial resistance or anti-colonial resistance in Vietnam.
Are we talking about arms sales?
No, we're actually talking about aid. We're talking about giving weaponry, huge amounts of weaponry. Including bullets, including all different forms of weaponry. And that's so basically, with the creation of NATO, there was the policy of supporting the NATO powers in Europe by the U.S. and Canada, providing huge amounts of weaponry through aid donations to the British, the French, the Portuguese, the Belgians, while those countries were suppressing independence movements in the case of British in Kenya, in the case of the French in Algeria and Vietnam, in the case of Belgium in the Congo, so this is basically post World War II, the European colonial powers were weak, and NATO, in large part, was about reasserting European colonial dominance, and sort of bringing it under the U.S.-led umbrella. That's why Americans, of course, provided huge amounts of support, where they were paying for much of the French war efforts in Vietnam in the post-World War II period. And then they obviously extended that over in subsequent decades. They sort of took over formally, so Canada was basically supporting the reassertion of European colonial dominance, and that's what the NATO, and that's a large part what NATO was actually entirely, the whole alliance was about at the time, and provided huge amounts of weaponry for that project.
I wanted to get back to something you said earlier about aid to the South Vietnamese regime. When you talk about aid for the South Vietnamese, what are you talking about?
Well, Canadian aid to South Vietnamese was basically aligned with U.S. Pacification efforts, with U.S. efforts to politically dominate South Vietnam. And that's, of course, what the bulk of the war effort was, U.S. was about in the South Vietnam, about asserting their political control, and Canadian aid allied with U.S. policy. And that's basically the central objective of Canadian aid in general, which is that I've called it the aid intervention principle. And so basically where you see U.S. and Canadian troops killing people, there's usually lots of Canadian aid going to there, and that's because aid is first and foremost a geopolitical tool, a tool of asserting Western power, and that existed in Vietnam in through the 60s, that existed in Korea in the early 1950s with the Canadian-U.S. war in Korea, that existed in more recent years in Afghanistan, huge increase Canadian aid in Iraq after the U.S. invasion, in Haiti after the U.S.-Canada intervention there. So aid usually aligns with geostrategic interests, and most obviously, war fighting being the most sort of crass form of assertion of Western geostrategic interests.
Hmm. You also mentioned earlier about the testing of chemical agents, that you mean stuff that would ultimately become Agent Orange, testing in the Maritimes. I assume we're not just talking about stuff in the laboratory.
No, of course. There's been thousands of people that lived on the base and around the base in New Brunswick that were harmed. Thousands of Canadians ultimately were harmed by the testing. They've been compensated even by after decades of battle over the issue, of campaigning over the issue. They've been compensated by the federal government because of all the illnesses that they suffered. And of course, the people who were living near the base where the testing was going on didn't suffer anything close to the Vietnamese. And it actually gets passed down. Some of the diseases from the chemical weapons, Agent Orange and others, Purple and others that were tested in CFB Gagetown, again, explicitly with the intention of aiding U.S. war effort, continue to have victims in Vietnam today, babies born today that continue to have birth defects and the like that flows out of that policy. And actually, if you go dig deeper into the whole history, Canada has this long history, decades-long history, goes back to World War II, of chemical weapons testing, of biological weapons warfare testing that was very much aligned with U.S. Testing and use of these horrific weapons in many different places.
I think one of the most common things people think about with regard to Canada in Vietnam is providing support for the draft dodgers that were coming into Canada. And that does seem to be at least one positive coming out of it. I mean, what would your reply be to some of the people who kind of hold that up as, maybe a slight compensation?
Clearly a good thing. Clearly opening borders to people who didn't want to go kill people in Vietnam was the right thing to do from the Canadian government's perspective, and so in that sense should definitely be applauded. But it needs to be looked at in a broader context, which is Canada's alignment broadly with the U.S. war effort. And one of the things, this is not the only example, I think also in the case of Chile in 1973, there was lots of Chileans that were led into Canada after Canada supported the U.S.-backed coup in Chile in 73. So a lot of people, they see that there was Chileans allowed in, there was American draft dodgers allowed in, and then that provides a sense that Canada was, doing well in the, by the war or against the war or whatever, but you have to look at some of the dynamics at play of in terms of letting the draft dodgers in. For instance, partly it was a response to anti-war movements in this country opposing Canada U.S. policy in Vietnam, and partly so those anti-war movements made some gains, and one of the gains they sort of made was a better policy around the draft dodgers. But it also needs to be looked at in the context that, from the standpoint of the Canadian government, these were often educated, Americans who were often sort of better off. It was younger people who often contributed quite quickly to the Canadian economy. So it was viewed as, and it often generally white. So it was viewed as a pretty good migrants to be allowing in or getting in, but it undoubtedly needs to be applauded that Canada let tens and tens of thousands of Americans in. But it also should be mentioned that there were tens of thousands of Canadians who fought in Vietnam. There were tens of thousands of Canadians who joined the U.S. military to fight. And there's something called the Foreign Enlistment Act in this country, which was set up during the Spanish Civil War when the Canadian government didn't want Canadians to go fight on behalf of the Republican Democratic forces against Franco in the 1930s in Spain, and the Foreign Enlistment Act is a little bit complicated about what violates the Foreign Enlistment Act, but the Canadian government wasn't attempting to stop Canadians from joining the American military to fight in Vietnam. So there's, you know, another side to the history of cross-border people flows that should also be discussed.
I'm going to ask just one more point from you, and maybe it's a bit of a sidebar, but you mentioned about the Chomsky's encounter with Zosky and the idea that they should rename the Pearson International Airport the War Criminal Airport or something to that effect. And I'm wondering, I mean, we're living in a time when they're talking about pulling down the statues of generals who fought in the Civil War on the Confederate side, or the John A. McDonald, who's, you know, notorious for his involvement in the oppression of Indigenous peoples in Canada. And I'm wondering if, consistent with that principle, I mean, if your serious thoughts about whether Pearson's name should be on an international airport, given his background.
I think the Toronto airport should be renamed. Unbelievably, Pearson is portrayed by much of the left, far into the left, even to sort of almost at the radical end of the Canadian left, as this sort of benevolent anti-war kind of figure. And in the case of Vietnam, the most ever cited speech of a Canadian politician supposedly opposing U.S. war was in the case of Vietnam. And this is a speech in 1965 at Temple University where Pearson supposedly opposed the U.S. war effort in Vietnam. And it's continues to be cited regularly today. In that speech, I quote, Lester Pearson said, "The government and great majority of people of my country have supported wholeheartedly the U.S. peacekeeping and peacemaking policies in Vietnam," end quote. So he says explicitly that they supported the American peacekeeping efforts in Vietnam, yet this speech at Temple University in 1965 is the most ever cited supposed anti-war speech by a Canadian politician against U.S. war, and basically all that Pearson did in the speech was he called for a short-term cessation of U.S. bombing of North Vietnam, supported the whole war effort in the South, called for a short-term tactical ending of bombing in North Vietnam, and this has been blown up, and we still see it in papers every 6 months, a year today. Blown up as this great anti-war speech, even though he's explicitly in favor of U.S. war policy. And it's an incredible comment on the sort of foreign policy intelligentsia and their ability to just completely rewrite the historical record when that record, you know, doesn't serve their objectives, and rewrite it in a way to, you know, portray Canada as a benevolent international force, which obviously has the important political ramifications today.
Eve Engler, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with author and Canadian foreign policy critic Eve Engler. You can find an archive of his articles at the website eveengler.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.